I will read two core poems and one English poem. They're all of me. The Blues. I came down the hill from Sunday's well to see a blue houseboat on the lee. I sit on the shaky bridge staring down at it and at the bluebird flag it flew, and at the woman who emerged onto the bank to fasten a washing line to a tree, then peg at least 10 pairs of blue knickers, all the time smiling, possibly at me. I sat down on the bridge, letting my legs dangle. I brushed my long hair away from my face as she disappeared back into the houseboat. For 5 full minutes she did not reappear. I was about to get vertical and leave when aching music seeped up to my ears, and I glimpsed her dancing in the doorway, changed into a blue thigh-length dress with a floppy blue hat on her head. I banished my yellow scarf into my bag, relieved I had chosen that morning a blue shirt. I felt reasonably sure my underpants were blue. I waved to her, but she took no notice. Then a man with a blue painted face arrived in a bicycle of fluorescent blue to jump up and grab her in an embrace. I realized I'd been ambushed by the Blues. Two crutches left leaning against the wall on the Sunday's Well Road. Two rubber-tipped toes crossing each other on the pavement. Above the armholes, a shawl of ivy. A long, long shawl. More than enough for 100 crutches. All left abandoned in Sunday's Well Road. But let us stay with the came across, too. Where is the individual who owns them? Has his sprained ankle healed itself? His amputated leg grown down again? Has he been raised up into heaven? Or is he levitating inside an invisible UFO, bound for a place none of us will visit? Ah, why didn't I take the crutches home to see what they might slowly reveal? They looked so right against that wall, like they'd been frozen in a dance. They looked like no crutches I'd seen. There was no ghost of a face above them. The lighthouse on the hill. It's set in the north of England and in the south. They built a lighthouse on top of the hill, high above the town. Beyond it stretched the sands of Morecambe Bay, across which, at low tide, processions of people picked their way, joined sometimes by coaches carrying royalty. What never loomed there were ships, nor were any rocks to be seen. On good days, a stream of climbers took the steep, twisting path to the top, hoping for a glimpse of the Isle of Man, but seeing anyway, far out into the bay, knowing maybe that hundreds of miles to the south, another bigger lighthouse, shaped like this one, saved countless ships from the rocks, and the man who made it came from this town, so they built this small lighthouse on top of the hill, enabling anyone approaching at night to see its soft light shine on his town.
Thank you very much, thank you. Brilliant. Next up, Jennifer Matthews.
Page from your All right. I just have an announcement. I am resuming the poetry discussion. Next week we're discussing Allen Ginsberg. So if you'd like to come by at 7:30 here to talk about him with me, I have three poems here for you. It is 8 pages. It's Howells. It's one poem. So I'm going to run around really quickly before the next poet. Just put your hand up if you want Allen Ginsberg, and if you're going to come next week. Okay. Right. See you.
Hey! You have to cover me.
Thanks anyway. No. Next up to the mic is Mr. Adam Coffey. He wants to be known.
Irish language poetry, and I have a translation as well. Just one little note from the translation. The first lines of the verse start a Cree of sorts, and that translates literally as like part 20, but it could also be to a lover, so it's designed to be ambiguous. That's what we're going across in English. Two on the lock on chin, a tall and cunis is run birthday green. A crea store, nodding glore, but she me cart the lock on chin, a tall and scale cart a green. A crea store, aged ween glore, tall and fear na own, we won on glore. Tá Mishra agus Tusa in our tear fame. Tá an Giles a glas is maana me gdeshu. Chin an scale. Mi lein scale ala ex a soil to him is too fame. Don't make a sound. They're wrong out there, but we have the correct story. Heart, honey, listen beneath the noise. The truth is there under the silence. Thank you. silence is the truth, and me and you are in our own country. The divide is melting, and my soul is healing. That's the story. That's the only story that I want. And yourself.
Circus, Tuesday night, the flurry of moving images, costumes sparkle, all ages, cultures, backgrounds and creeds share this collective experience. Practice is essential. Poise still, place and hoops, juggle all you can. Unicycle chaos, a sweaty warm-up for the fittest and fattest. Clack, clip, spinning colour, of the devil with his sticks. The contact crystal ball hypnotically reads my fortune. A relaxed flow of students, intellectuals, hippies and happy caretakers paint this rich picture. Deep-rooted music encapsulates the mood. We are here together in this intangible moment of creativity. 8 o'clock comes ever too soon. Never enough time to perfect that one vital skill. Can't wait until next week. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was interesting, I met a guy from England, a guy called John Lee, who is an expert in clowning. I know that sounds strange, but he knows how clowning works and how to bring out the comedy character in people. And I got talking to him, and he was one of the first people in London who was juggling apples, pears and oranges outside Covent Garden, and everybody was saying, oh, you know, circus is finished and clowns finished, everything's going to the theatre. And he told us this little story about how the Arts Council made a shift in their thinking in England and kind of following through. I mean, there was a street performance company from France called the Sultan's Elephants. I don't know if you've heard of it. But basically what had happened was they did a week's performance and shows around different parts of England, and then they had a parade in London, and 1,000 people turned up for this 3-day parade on the first day. Then 10,000 came the second day, and those 10,000 people took a little device out of their pocket, a mobile phone, rang their friends and said, you need a video. And a million people turned up in London to see this thing on the street. So it was just like, even Billboard is here, doesn't have anything, but it's like the streets out there, you know, there's definitely something. I don't know, that's story came out there, so I thought I'd share with you. When we got more story, man, we got one more point there. All my friends have gone ripped and pulled by yellow machines with huge bucket hands. The children used to play in here, but their voices are here no more. I'm here alone, solitary, observing this world. My green bed has been snatched and replaced with grey and chrome. New life diminished in a moment, my freedom gone. I'm tall and strong, I've seen many years go by. I remember my first few years as I popped my head from the dark into the radiant, healing yellow sun. I felt a change in the air, my sense of a looming crisis ever present. Thank you very much.
Up to the microphone is an excellent soul, Writers of the Week winner, Mr. John Friedman.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. This is a little excerpt from an essay on umbrellas that I acquainted with you with a few weeks ago. It's called Choosing an Umbrella. Going into a store to choose an umbrella is a tricky task for a man. You see racks of colourful floral umbrellas everywhere. It's almost as bad as straying into the women's lingerie section, where you have to adopt the innocent expression of a man who wouldn't know what women's underwear was if he were half strangled with it. You rummage around at the umbrella stands trying to look nonchalant, with a kind of passing interest. You try to appear like a man who's really en route to buy some tools in the DIY section. Female assistants may cast sidelong glances at you, so that the rain outside seems to be quite minor after all, and you keep glancing at the doors, wondering why you came in at all. Now, the coloured umbrellas are a no-go area. They are like cork, way beyond the pale. No, the only choice is black, funereal black. With one exception, the golf umbrella. In principle, this will not compromise you in terms of your manliness, but it is colourful and large, so as you walk down the street, children who don't seem to have any parents around to control them will make comments like, "Make way for the circus," and they will follow you down the street like you were an early installment of Thunderland. You'll be like the sinister Pied Piper luring children off, so steer clear of the golf umbrella. This leaves us with the black ones. Real men choose black, and size does matter. Now, there are two possibilities. You can buy a little small fold-up one that will keep someone in China in a job, and you can neatly conceal it in a pocket and go your way with a sunny expression, and no one would ever suspect your secret. The bad thing is that at the first gust of wind, the little black canopy shoots upwards from its frail metal structure. You shudder it back down, but it is quite misshapen now. All up on one side and down on the other, it keeps you dry on one side only, sending generous sheets of water down your neck on the other side. In order to remedy this, you have to walk with a kind of corrective list, like a man with a bad back. You may look like a boat about to go down. I myself have quite a collection of these now. On average, they survive two outings, at which point their only use is to throw it straight out. Now, the last choice available to the real man is the large black umbrella. But this has some serious disadvantages. It is Dickensian. It cannot be concealed. You need to commit yourself every morning. If there's a cloud on the horizon, you're reluctant to leave without it. Even if the sky is clear, you know it might rain later on, so you take the death shroud with you. The disadvantage is that you will, as you stride along with your black bat wing by your side, people will think you're going to a funeral and nod sympathetically. But they won't like you. You're a bad omen, a pessimist. They feel that if an early summer were declared, you'd be a conscientious objector. And on a crowded street, people have to draw aside as you sweep morbidly along. And in a misty drizzle, harmless droplets will congregate on its vast, dark canopy, and you may feel like a man who has overreacted. And then if it's a windy day, it seems to attract the wind. To put it up is like keeping sails up in a storm. It's the worst possible thing you could do. You're only asking for trouble. You're pulled wildly around with it in all directions, and you feel that at any moment you might soar off like Mary Poppins. So one hopeful day in early spring, you leave it behind you in the shop, pretending to forget it. Unfortunately, an interfering old lady runs after you with it. She saw you bring it in. It's yours. You can't get away from it. That's the problem with the damn thing. People notice it. They associate you with it. But if you're determined and wise, things will eventually go your way. And one day, you leave it quietly behind you. And no one runs after you to tip you on the shoulder and hand it back to you. And even if that day is overcast and rain is threatening, it's a good day. There may be dark clouds in the sky, but the darkest one of all is gone. It's resting against the counter where you have abandoned it. And now you're a man with new hope. You're a dreamer again. You have rejoined to damp humanity. You're young. You will live henceforth like the lilies of the field. You have thrown caution and your umbrella to the wind. Henceforth, you will get wet. You have understood at last how wise the old adage is. Never trouble trouble. So trouble troubles you. You'll only double trouble and trouble others too. Thank you.
Last week, Pat Potter's wonderful collection was launched here in Cork, and Pat is going to read from that now. Pat Potter, thanks.
Pat. I heard during the week there that Douglas Kennedy is going to be reading Cork during the Able Book Fest. That reminded me of an old anecdote. I heard about Douglas Kennedy. He was inside Waterstones one Christmas in this long queue, and suddenly he noticed that a very attractive young woman standing in front of him had a sheet of about six books, and one of the books was his. So after, you know, pausing for a while, he tapped her on the shoulder. My name is Douglas Kennedy, and I'm delighted that you've chosen to buy one of my books this Christmas. She looked at me and she said, "Fuck off, creep." So, for those of you who I haven't thanked for buying my book, now you know why. Anyway, look, part of Christian theology is the belief that when you resurrect, you resurrect in full health. So that if you ever suffer an amputation during your life, you rise with two legs. And one of the things that kept medieval theologians busy was whether or not Christ would be reunited with his foreskin. Had been reunited with his foreskin when he resurrected and went to heaven. And, you know, monks came to fisticuff fights over that kind of thing. And anyhow, so those kind of theological ideas, and also the belief that anything involves participation in human beings never quite works out as promises in the perspective, informs this poem called Last Day. When the trumpet called, I made for the ancestral graveyard, waited 10 minutes before resurrection, before slitting my throat. Did it just as I've always pictured it. One swift slice of the juggler with an even-weighted black-handled blade. As the skin parted on my neck, my heart jumped to my throat, where for a few too long seconds it pumped harder the remaining blood which hadn't yet drained. Poor heart felt and bursting with its own pain. Blackness descended on my brain as capillaries drying. I was dazed and drowsy when minutes later the corpuscles leapt back into my throat like miniature scarlet salmon. Stumbling naked women, dusted with earth, arose around me and sang aloud plaintive songs in return, songs of imploring for the missing tresses of youth. A few feet away, a murdered American, never identified, wondered about the whereabouts of his absent preppy. How is this thing supposed to work, he asked. Does it come to me or must I go back to Vermont to collect it? I shrugged my shoulders in response. Or was I just in spasm? Okay, you only ever see me in the evening, so I've got a warning out of how we look in the morning. Phone call indirect from the killer. Well, actually, I got a haircut, so, but before I got the haircut, this morning, my hair stands shocked. Thin peaks of grey flame poised to scorch to ash any naive soul who might glimpse. The beauty nymphs slumber still in the wall cracks around me, heads resting on bedbugs for pillows. The same damned bedbugs I've been unable to poison since the male-ordered nymphs moved in, shacked up. Impatient, envious, I thump the wall. Why should I be insomnia's solitary victim? Engine to a thousand nighttime anxiety. I sit here dark and brooding, a separate weather system in the rumpled mountain range of my bedclothes, before thumping the walls again, buckling the cheap veneer cladding, forcing the nymphs out of their holes. They stream like screeching miniature bats. My skin's flaky patches are rapidly spat upon, then polished by a thousand invisible wings. A million bombard my head with perfumed guano, styling the entire luminous morass into the latest post-Vidal Sassoon pre-whatever formation. The red whips streaking from irises across the whites of my eyeballs are massaged into temporary invisibility, and eventually I stand before the mirror without danger of it cracking. Marveling at the memory of distant days, when I looked like this, better. 24 hours a day, sleep or no sleep, no veneer, no bed bugs, no nymphs, no anxiety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Pat. And Pat will have his books here in a few weeks' time, some of the paperbacks, but it's just in hardback as well, so we'll be selling them here the rest of the books. Next up, the microphone is Patricia Welch.
Thank you, Jim. This poem which I wrote today doesn't have a title, but please bear with me. Dense at the extent of local glory, cracked skull in disrepair, is extremely hazardous to swallow the kiss. What for alcoholic joy, did that belong to you? No, it's stolen from me. Why would I want to meditate, temporarily vanquish all my thoughts, when I can no longer think of you as an intruder taking folly on the breast of love from a traitor? I want to get to know you more, for you have become the side of my enemy. I can vanquish you both and mock the needs I feel on. Love, what does it mean to you when you opened your diary to me? What do you like? What am I like? Am I so stupid to think I deserve love from anyone? Don't leave me to humiliate myself any longer if you don't feel the same. But if so, thank you for your cooperation. Thank you. And this one's called The Edible Alcoholic. He squats by the tailbone and weeps like a melting glacier. His belly and legs crunch into the sea like a mating hooch. The city is compacted with the lights of the Dutch gold cans navigating along Save yourself from what you have lost. Keeping both nodes on the cave's control. Death has come from somewhere. A hole from home, from a home from home. Ishkabaha gives you the reward for keeping the tax in a pocket. This, as dirty, as scared as you've lived, in a borrowed coffin and plot, mourners queuing up for a share of shadows, numbing the pleasure of survivor stories of those run dry, the horror of the healing, bright despair, buying time for a wet hospital city and finding comfort in below zero, being edible, neither short, no purpose left except to die, being foolfully fortunate, lecturing in abstinence in the presence of the Holy One, I guess.
And now I'm standing up to the mic, Seamus Harrington.
Mobile dog wash. Just across the road are deadly spinning wheels, where every puppy shows the cleanest pair of heels. Pegasus. Parts merge to enchant, then Zeus, he is gone in one lightning bolt, blowtorch sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I'll return to spot stars on his flanks, hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. In the port of Gothenburg, there's a tall ship. There's a tall bridge outside, but she's trapped. And that's okay, because she's a very handsome restaurant and a hotel. And this is her story. And the word truck appears at the start. That's also the disc at the top of the mast. And Piper sound appears at the end. That is the entrance to the port of Katagonga. And her name is the Viking. The Viking. I have no truck with mock-tar ships, bulimic tanks of liquid gold. I don't propose to bend a knee, and never would on step a mast, to suit that bridge that hems me in, to harbour years of gangway life. I'll stay secured and keep each guest, their posh hotel, my tumble home. My figurehead will often test a jaundiced eye on Lego ships, with cargo boxed in vivid stacks, bad-mannered ribs and soap dish boats that skim across my basin berths, and towering hulks decked out in glass where bubbling pools of idle rich or landsmen soak their golden hinds. My secret wish has always been return again to naval days. The trill and ring of ordered steps, a manifest of fresh cadets to line the yard's parade of sail, those spokesful airs of every ilk, or master's voice across the poop, and gimbaled hours away offshore. The soundless mitt of bosun's pet, his musing gaze as flying fish play and break about my lee cat head in distant roads, the wind, the song, the transcendent moon for ebb and flow. I'd love to seek a further voyage, secluded shores I yet to trace, like sights within the piper sounds. And yes, I miss this canvas stress, feel foot rope dance where topmen tread, at harbour's mouth a lash of salt to rinse my plunging pencil line, a creaking sheave to quiet routine, ice broken clear in furrowed drills, the sizing wind at each crow's nest, a field of wheat discharged at last. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Amy. Now please let Sir Richard Owen speak.
Thank you. You're all probably familiar with Michael O'Leary, who's Kaufman, Brian Eyre, and the battle he's had with Aer Lingus over the last few years. I recently wrote a poem, I write a lot of corporate poetry, I just write them and send them off to different companies if they accept them long ago, it's not true. I wrote this one to Michael O'Leary, I've got a letter here on my wallet, he's quite interested in this. So it's very short, it's really just a year ago. Bumblebees, Boeing, Buzz, Aeroflux, and Qantas Duds. There's one which all the other licks, Cunnilingus, ring by pricks. Anyway, I was recently made the port laureate of La Coste, it's a little village in the Rubon, South France. It might sound like a very prestigious appointment, but there's only 170 people living in the village, and there's only two contenders. There was a guy called Tom Stoppard, who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for literature, and I. If you might also remember or hear, recall the story about Oscar Wilde. When Oscar Wilde actually got out of Reading jail, he went to Paris, and he actually died in Paris. He was lying in his bedroom, and apparently the wallpaper was ghastly. And he looked up at the wallpaper and he said, one of us has got to go. It was like that when Mr. Stoppard and I, Tom left. But before he left, we co-wrote a poem, which is a rather strange thing, really. You know, you hear Roger Hammerstein and David Southern. You don't normally get co-authors of poetry. This is a poem about the Luberon Mountain. I think there's some French people here tonight. You might be familiar with the Luberon Mountain. But the Luberon Mountain is a very feminine looking mountain, and this is about a snowfall on the mountain, and my observation of it. I wrote the poem, but I could never come up with a title for it. And as I'm the gardener for Mr. Stoppard, I asked him would he put a title on it, and this is how, this is why we're co-authors of the poem. He titled the poem Virgin Bride. Basically, it was my interpretation of the mountain covered in snow pretending to be a virgin, but in actual fact it had some senior relationships with Springsteen or not, and here's the poem, Virgin Bride. White-frocked virgin earth, conceal your imperfections before the light of sun demands to see within the chastity of your garden lace. Toss your snowdrop bouquet to the blizzard wind and mock the innocence of its confetti grace. And smile mischievously at all the seasoned suitors you have graced. That's that one. Thank you very much. This is the poem I wrote about a self-explanatory poem called Swan Song. The only word that might throw you off is the word peace. It's actually an epic, T-E-A-T, not this one, 10 years old. Swan song. Black swan flapping, frantic skipping, and toe tapping, testing, pasting, wind beneath unfurling feathers, hitting, whipping, splashing, joking, others looking, mocking, joking, out of breath. Choking, thought-provoking, gagging, hissing, panting, missing, escaping, not so easy as a water's chop on each gigantic stroke. Wetting magnifies those spanning tips like downward suction, teeth on lips or dipping bows of steaming ships, resisting, persisting, aging, fading, gravity engaging, fearing, despairing, deciding, gliding, no more resting, unwantingly alone. I'll do one more point here. It's called a fresh loaf. It's basically the recipe, ingredients, and cooking methods for Irish sourdough. I can remember my grandmother taking eggs from under a hen, and on the way back, squirting milk from the other cow, swish-swash, into a kind of nice bucket. Out on the sill, souring lactose with like a white brain and preserving fluid, and together with the chicken jewel was on the same colour as the house of Yellow Dokra. The mixing bowl resembled the World War I soldier's helmet with near escapes of hand-picked enamels and skirmishes around the fair docks. Hands all sipped the flour in memorized couples, sauce and pinch and haste across the moon as shoulder breast, fire or puffs which smoke the walls and pan caressed, soda rising, raisin frosting, window cooling, dough to crust. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sundar. And next up the microphone is Sundar O'Malley.
Hey.
This one's called the Enigma of Attraction. This is our night in oblivion. Thoughts and feelings become distorted. Are our brains becoming too blunted? A crossfire of emotion shooting blindly. Is sensitivity that difficult to find? One drink too many, no scent for a penny. Our eyes always hunt for a prize. A chance, just one loony then, until our blood runs numb with excitement. Close, closer, the scent of skin. Sweating, rising, grooving, soothing. Dancing feet of passion, bursting into flames. Hormone just too difficult to tame. Smell her scent and remember her warm embrace. Feel helpless when you smile at her jovial face. Laughing maniacally till we fall on the floor. Endless tears that conceal a river. Yes, it's the humour that we adore. We can gaze for ages at both our faces. So close, skin to skin, and flesh to flesh. Despair, anticipation for that elusive kiss. A lofty sensation not to be missed. Can the fantasies be put to a test? Will it be long till wishes are blessed? Do we want to strive for harmony and bliss? Wait for it, patiently. Thanks.
Hey.
I finished off with a haiku. I went to a 70s teen party the other night. And, you know. Archaeologists are rolling on roller skates. Some crazy party. Thanks.
Something you must be able to instead of reading it before. Pat. Well, Paul Casey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cole. Good to be a poet and not an MC. Before I say anything, I need to know if there's any debraiding in the world. I've got 29 braids in my hair from this gig I did in Wexford. And I can't get them out, and they're going to turn into dreadlocks, so I don't want to take my hair off. So, if anyone like you who's keen to come along and debraid my braids, then let me know. And I'll buy you some wine or something. A reach purchase. Yeah, it was 24 poems in 24 hours, based on 24 interviews with 24 people, 24 questions, 24 answers, which were the foundation for each line of each poem. And I can't say any of them because they were personal to me and the person, so they're not really my poetry, it's like a combination of poetry. But instead, these three people who are here, these crowd of French enthusiasts are here. They're all in Wexford, so you can ask them about it. Good fun, yeah?
Yeah.
Three different artists, three different art forms. All of them. It was great. Anyway. So, I kind of thought, I came in here and I thought, I can't say any of these 24 poems, and what am I going to do, you know? I'm not going to bring out one of these,
performance commissions from the past. So
I sat here today and wrote this poem. It was called Smoke. Concept splits prisoner cave. What hue will do? The need of the world, the work of the world, fun in the world, self, history, personal paradigm, personal sense of the big picture. What is more valuable to develop? Political response. The best possible self. It all varies. The best possible self? It all varies. Perhaps nothing is good for a while. Then a snapshot or pan of the day. Then a reinterpretation of myth. Something spiritual, perhaps, praising the praiseworthy, few of whom are human. A small percentage, that is. Satire. Only if it excites orchestral laughter. No more diatribe. The vitriolic tale spins its own source. Unless politically actualized, perhaps. An ode to suffering and to courage. Some talk of the joys of work, knowledge, my family, one by one. Those I have and do love, mention the plight of the helpless, of the marginalized, create a formula for changing the establishment from within. Of the reach of cross-discipline, of the rewards of personal faith, of the unending need for love, of the wisdom in empathy, of the lack of respect for artists. I have written of anger in its forms, the tsunami kind, and its containment. The irksome genre, unitchable, of the ashes left by its rays. Pan through life. Be where you began, and be where you are. Speak of joy. Let it not be forgotten. In it is the substance of purpose and inspiration. Its story will help the great to endure and become what the world needs them to. Talk of restraint, of the safety net given by the imagination, where we can live out the things the world disallows and consider them in hindsight as good races run. Of forgetting, letting go, of endurance and gifts, the tests of integrity, of the foundations of character and their creation, of the abstract mirrors of the mind, of the sovereignty of the heart. Talk of what makes it all worthwhile, of when talk is more than talk, of natural death, of natural talk, of a thoughtful talk crafted to give you a word. And silence and where it belongs. And as talk can drown in its rain, the platinum rain of silence, suspending the standard for talk to outdo. So let's talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carl. Now please welcome David Winter.
This is called Monster, tied together from words. In the basement of an abandoned castle, toying with an amalgamated language, a test tube filled by a vagabond's ramble. A beaker of delirious grammar, the boiling cauldron of my crude conclusion. I tear off punctured concepts like broken condoms and patch together a sackcloth hide for my bitter theme. The pen and cracked bone, the pen's stolid desire for order, the pen's sharp mix of metaphor the pen's lack of personal conviction, the pen's inhuman voice, the pen's monstrous unthought. Boys will do what boys will do, and monsters too, pressing themselves into unknown terror like the visage of Victor's boy, who murdered all that his god loved, simply because his god did not love him. But I will teach this monster to recognize its father. He will be my self-portrait, as all the pen's children are self-portraits. I will care for him until he plucks the apple from my throat. We will share the apple, and slather each slice with thick layers of peanut butter or honey. But after that, I will take no responsibility for the words that I have written. I will not pay child support or follow the creature a step beyond the door. I will send him into the wilderness with his belly full of knowledge, a torch to light his way across the glaciers, murdering those that I love. Boys will do what boys will do, and monsters, too, pressing themselves into the threat of the unknown, cute and diseased, sexual only in its implications, like the visage of Victor's boy. Growing up is just like that.
Next up, we'd like to call this night by Lord Samuel or Saul Harding.
Nice to see the French paper tonight, Frankie Murphy. Many Romans, go for Romans, though. Not many people know that Romans came to Cork in 79 AD. And then we played in Murphy's and tried them.
Wow,
it was all moment, eh? It's called Death Wish. It's where a lot of people like to die. When death fell on me like a loose leaf, it didn't dangle, just came to rest on my shoulder, brought no grief. I did not expect him. My door was open. I heard no gentle knocking. Although the branches were slightly moving, the wind was even. When death fell on me like a bird's feather in an airy dance, there was no land or a ceiling that the dance was over. It's called Victim, January 15, 2008. This is when I first walked out of the Supreme Court after causing problems. It's about the undead, Kevin spoke about, and vampires, I suppose. No one first octane is the abuser, and the second one is the victim, and so on. No one knows me, after all, I've been proud. Goldilocks will never know until I am satiated. Nothing else matters, and the secret is fastened by a dog. Who can I tell? No one would believe me. Why? Devils like that do not exist. Anyway, it's my fault. I encouraged them. Now the awful nightmares will not leave me. There is no register, and from town to town I can go and gain someone else's trust. This I must do, I surely must, and inevitably break down that trust. I trust nobody now, no one at all. My heart is broken into piercing shards. In the restless hours, the mumbled words that wish to scream out just idle on and stall. But I go on and on, I must go on. There are no thrills there for me. No other thrills there for me, little faces, boy or girl. Then my loneliness will last at least one or time and be gone. Where can I go now in this blank land, in this bleak land? I see the normal people come and go, our secret will remain until the snow returns, or a snowman with sparkling wand.
Thank you very much, sir. Next up, we're going to have our French guest tonight, Marie Claire.
It was the flow. It's just French for us. So, okay, I wasn't supposed to get credit tonight, but a friend of mine wrote my name on the list from here. And, yes, it's the friend, Daniel.
I'm very happy with my fault.
Good for you.
He's a liar,
yes. So I read a part of the book of a French writer named Pierre Michaud. I don't know if you know, it's a French writer who wrote about Arthur Rimbaud, French poet. And I will translate the end in English, I will try. But the beginning will be in French.
Il a écrit la saison. Je peux l'imaginer sortant la nuit dans la cour de roche quand les moissonneurs sont couchés. Il a bien travaillé lui aussi. C'est juillet et les grandes étoiles. Il y a sous les étoiles des moches sombres comme dans l'histoire de Boulle. On ne voit pas Rimbaud qui est là, le cheveu mal en ordre, l'œil bien ouvert, la main grande, tout très réservée, secret comme postulé dans l'ombre fraîche de la nuit. Il est accroupi contre cette meule. On l'entend. Il dit des phrases écrites dans la journée avec une émotion très grande, peu comparable à tout autre au monde depuis que Dieu est parti du cœur des hommes. Et s'il y a des puissances dans l'air, si, comme le poème de Boud l'affirme, elles aiment particulièrement à s'ébattre par les nuits de moisson, elles reconnaissent ce grand émoi qu'elles ont vendu jadis en Judée, à Rome et à Saint-Cyr, partout où on a rythmé la langue dans les mois. Elles le connaissent. Nous aussi, nous le connaissons, nous savons que ça existe. Et nous ne savons pas vraiment ce que c'est. Nous ne savons pas vraiment ce qui bondit dans ce cœur d'homme volontaire ou de fille, à l'unisson des mots qui roulent dans sa bouche. Les étoiles attentives, distraites, clignent. La voix dans le noir dit la saison pour les étoiles. La main grande se referme, l'émoi grandit, la voix fait venir les larmes. Nous savons que cet émoi existe. Les étoiles dansent à travers les feuillages sombres. La maison est plus noire que la nuit. Ah, c'est peut-être de t'avoir enfin rejointe et de tenir embrassée, mère qui ne me lit pas, qui dort à point fermé dans le puits de ta chambre. Mère, pour qui j'invente cette langue de bois au plus près de ton deuil ineffable, de ta clôture sans issue. C'est que j'enfle ma voix pour te parler de très loin, père qui ne me parlera jamais. Qu'est-ce qui relance enfin la littérature? Qu'est-ce qui fait écrire les hommes, les autres hommes, leurs mères, les étoiles ou les vieilles choses énormes? Dieu, la langue, les puissances le savent. Les puissances de l'air font ce feu de vent à travers les feuillages. La nuit tourne. La lune se lève. Il n'y a personne contre cette lune. Rimbaud dans le grenier parmi les feuillets s'est tourné contre le mur et dort comme un plomb. The saison is the season in L. I think you know what you said. And the end in my English, my fourth English, the stars are dancing among the leaves. The house is darker than night. And why I'm doing this book, maybe why people write, why Rimbaud wrote this book. Maybe it's because he joined his mother and killed her. Mother who never read my book, who slept well out of bedroom, for who I invent this language closest to you today.
Morning.
What?
Morning.
Okay.
Closest to your mourning, to your death, your death without out. It's because I make my voice noisier, so talking to my father, father will never speak to me. What makes literacy as your end, and poetry as your end? Why people write and speak poetry? The other people, men, women, the mother, the south, or maybe it's because the big all things, God, language, just big knowledge know this. The knowledge of air, or this little wind between the ships. The night is turning, the moon is rising up. There's no one against this wall. And rumble on the wind.
The attic.
Rumble in the attic among this ship turns its back to the wall and sleeping for years. Come on, please.
Like a lead
for you. That's the end.
A very important announcement, last round, get your original. Okay, last but not least, our favorite band is Celine.
Had to go to Dublin to do an exam, and instead of practicing for an exam, I wrote this. So I feel the exam, you're all in there. And it's called Troubles. It wasn't easy growing up in the north in the early 90s. Plans for prosperity hadn't been written. There was no talk of house prices or four-wheel drive yokes. The Celtic Tiger wasn't even a kitten. As some would say, it was a miserable time. Immigration, unemployment, and men having to do the double. Everyone seemed to hate each other, and their lives were dominated by the troubles. Well, good luck to that. I had troubles of my own. I was going through puberty, growing boobs, and had my eye on a boy. I had no time to be bothered with political affairs, for I had a teenage life to explore and try to enjoy. My troubles. I couldn't go to school on non-uniform day unless my shell suit had a label, and the only chance I got of seeing my crush was by memorising his entire school timetable. And I dread waking up in the morning in case I had a spot, and I'd go off to school looking like crap, only to be tortured by Barry in double math, who had a mad obsession with pulling in the back of my bra strap. I was always knuff at school, never really able to lose weight until now, and I remember walking past a group of hot salads who chanted they had all seen better legs than a cow. Then we'd have our school disco, and I'd get myself and I'd do myself up to no end to be approached by a hottie who'd turn and point at the fat one and say, would you go with my friends? Most of my school life was taken up by my crush on a certain Mr. Divide. Oh, how I plastered his name in every file, book and folder. I planned our courtship, engagement and marriage in the name of our children because I was so certain we'd be together when we were older. Along came an event where I knew I'd get my chance, for I was old enough now to go to the Christmas dance. I knew that I wouldn't have to ask him or wonder if he'd say no, because I went to the Christmas disco accompanied with a big clump of mistletoe. When I got there, I boogied away till one of my friends told me something I didn't like, and I looked around over to the corner to see the love of my life, Curtin Mary, the school bike. That was it. My world was over. My heart was broken. The light of day had gone from my life. Oh, how I cried for days, months and years at the realisation I would never be Seamus' wife. So you see, my teenage years came plenty with troubles and strife, but when I think about it, all the good and bad, I say those days were the best of my life.
Okay, that's the end of this. Like, I want to thank you again, and a big round of applause for Gary King for reading tonight. Thanks very much. Please remember, everybody, don't forget the OVEA website. Use the OVEA website, put your comments on it, see the forthcoming posts you're going to read, and there's lots of the videos on the website as well. And don't forget the books we have here for sale. Okay? Thanks a lot. Take care.
Adam Myers does a writing class out here every Monday morning. He's also going to be doing evening classes in the next coming weeks. He asked me to get a list of people together who might be interested in creative writing classes. So if you can see me, I'll take your name and number down at the end. Thank you. I don't know if we got that.
And for the cheapest audio, we're going to play a bit of music and probably, we're going to go, you know, just going to climb in here for a second to our normal spot. And everyone's like telling me the story of which I worry about, which is Long Valley. Frank Lowe, do you know what's going on in the corner? Yeah. Listen, there's a thing called goldfish. And the goldfish has a memory span of 5 seconds, okay? Yeah. All right?
Three.
I'm telling you, it does. 5 seconds, that's it. And then, if you cross your T's, what do you do to your eyes? What do you do to your eyes if you cross your T's? There you go. You tickle your eyes. There's no such thing as a dot on an eye. It's a tickle. Which has given me a greater insight into our next poet, Mr. Alan Fisher.
I'm not sure actually if this is a poem, but it's a chunk of a story which is poetic, which might be the same thing, which I wrote some years ago, and it's kind of biographical, not autobiographical, and the piece involves a series of questions as to what somebody learned in the course of his life. And the question is, what did he learn in the course of his life? And this is a series of answers. What did he learn in the course of his life? He learned that he was nobody's fool, that money opened all doors, that speech is the mother of troubles, that the house of bondage had many whips, that a small, still voice is never heard, that out of the mouths of babes and sucklings comes forth dribble, that 2 and 2 made 4 sometimes, that the writing on the wall was never clear, that there was not much beyond wit's end, that he that spareth the rod had no sons, that the philosophic pill gilded nothing, that between the candy store in the corner and the chapel on the hill there was a lot of corn, that blue was the colour of his true love's hair rinsed in the morning, that there were many good reasons for doing nothing, that a long finger was better than a thumb, that the sheep shall inherit the earth, that those who go down to the sea in ships are usually sailors, that the whores of wood had drawers of water, that one should give a lie for a lie and a truth for a truth, that whereof one cannot speak, one is obliged to bullshit, that the only way out was back, that the answer was blowing in the wind, that it was always dirty on the pig's back, that the ball was the name of the game, that a radical shit goes to the root of things, that the delta of Venus demanded a lot of tributes, that the fool on the hill watches over all, that he didn't like Mondays, that coke was the real thing, that a friend indeed was a friend with speed, that the ogres of thought were not as effective as the curses of obstruction, that raw data tastes best when cooked, that most poetry is a heinous sham, that going to the wall doesn't mean you have to wail about it, that now is sooner than then, that the great architect never got a degree, that it was difficult to swing on the roundabouts, that the tooth doesn't always out, that to be or not to be isn't even a question. That he who dares sings that every Tom and Dick is hairy. That smart cookies don't crumble. That a wild goose chase sometimes caught a white elephant. That it was easier to fly than to stay up. That all slips were Freudian. That hush puppies rarely bark.
that forked fingers were more feared than forked tongues, that screwball was a kind of cocktail, that a bird in the pan meant none in the bush, that walking a plank meant you made a big splash, that farce was better than force, that the broad-green nag wasn't half as bad as the bob-tailed nag, that insultants shouldn't earn more than consultants, that you couldn't squeeze a lemon out of lemonade, that his gun was for hire even if it was only dancing in the dark, that lust we are and not lust we always turn, that hard cheese was a tough titty, that the flighty are often calling, that crabbed sages and truth would always go together, that life was a hard crack, slut to crack, that there was no rule like misrule, that nobody mattered diddly squat, and that everything was long way up Ship Creek and past turning.